Welcome back to Human Emotion. So today we're going to discuss both love as well as sex and ask ourselves, just how does emotion play a role here? So for example, we'll ask the question in some ways like, what does love and sex got to do with it? So exactly to what extent does emotion shape the love we feel towards others as well as our patterns of sexual desire and arousal? So we're going to follow this roadmap today. We'll start by talking about love, moving to desire, moving to some really controversial and provocative research on sexual arousal, followed by takeaway questions and an expert interview with Dr. Michael Bailey. So let's start with love. So romantic love, what is it in the first place? So we know romantic love is something that we all have some sense of, we've read about, and many of us one day hope to experience. So let me share a few features about what psychologists and people who study human emotion think romantic love actually is. So we think of romantic love as something that underlies pair bonding between partners, and that it's thought to help foster long-term commitment and also help people stay together in terms of fostering mutual goals. Ultimately, romantic love really seems to be about keeping people together so that they can rear offspring over the long-term course. Okay. So that doesn't sound very romantic at all. What else is romantic love associated with? Well, we also know that it's associated with the release of a neuropeptide you may have heard of called oxytocin. So this has been colloquially referred to as the love hormone, and that it's this hormone that's thought to make us feel romantic love and feel sort of attached and bonded with another romantic partner. And what I think is really fun is to look at what are the behavioral displays that people show when they're feeling in love. And so you see this funny combination of a head tilt, smile, and making this very subtle kind of coy eye contact. So what does this look like? So these are images courtesy of Dacher Keltner, who's been studying these displays of love, and here you can see exactly that. So you find that the head gets tilt slightly. People think it's a way of sort of displaying your vulnerability to another partner. You see this kind of subtle smile, and you also see eye contact. So many of you might remember times in which maybe you were in class when you were young, high school, college, where someone gave you that special look. And what that special look really was is the head tilting, looking at you, making eye contact, and smiling. So that's thought to be our sort of expressions or displays of love in the face. Okay, and what do we think about what romantic love is? So Sternberg had a theory of love, and this theory of love had three components. The first component was intimacy. So he talked about this as a feeling of closeness, connectedness, and bonding. So this is related to sharing information with this person that you wouldn't normally share with other people. That's the first component of love. The second was passion. So he talked about this notion of having desire. You need to have physical attraction, desire, and sort of the proclivity to want to have sex with the other person, right? And the third is this idea of long-term commitment. So this is the decision that one is in, this loving relationship. They're willing to label it as a relationship, which I know can be an issue for many kinds of relationships, that wanting to commit and say, I am in this relationship with you, and to maintain this relationship over time. So intimacy, passion, and commitment are the three components of love, according to Sternberg. And he noted that you need to have all three components in order to truly have romantic love. So what happens then if you are missing some of these components, if you have some but not all? So he walked through several different categories of different kinds of love-like feelings when you're missing one or more of these components. But keep in mind, these are no longer romantic love if you don't have all three. So what does it look like if you have different combinations of them? So first, he would say, there's something called non-love. So this is where you have none of the three components. You don't have intimacy, you don't have passion, you don't have commitment. There's no love going on there. liking. So we've heard people say, I really like you, I just don't love you. So what this is thought to be of is having this sense of intimacy only, feeling connected with the person, but not having the passion, the desire, and not really wanting to maintain that long-term commitment. So these are more of what we think of as, you know, I just want to be your friend, or casual friendships. Then there's infatuation. So here you have the passion, you have the desire, but you just don't feel that close connection and you're not really interested in staying with them in the long run. So people talk about this as love at first sight, that this is really more about sort of your sort of system of desire and sexual arousal and nothing more. And then there's empty love. So this is this sense of commitment. So you're in it for the long run to stay with this person, but you no longer are feeling intimacy or passion. This can often be a sad but final stage of long-term relationships that seem to have just kind of fizzled out or gone bad. So for example, it's, you know, better to just stay together for the kids' sake or for sort of social appearances. This empty love is often the first stage of a relationship in arranged marriages, which is interesting because later on they don't have a higher rate of ending in divorce. But it's also seen as the final stage often before couples will often divorce or split up. So here you're committed to the person, but you're missing some of the two key ingredients of intimacy and passion. There's also this sense of romantic love. So what's interesting here, this is sort of what we see in story tales, right? Think of like Romeo and Juliet, right? So here you have the intimacy, you have the passion, but for different reasons, you're unable to make that commitment to be with them long term. Some people also think of things like the Titanic as well. Then there's companionate love, right? So this is what you feel for like a really good, really close best friend. So you have the sense of intimacy and closeness. You have the commitment. You want to stay being close to them for a very long time, but there's just no sexual desire or arousal. So that's companionate love, right? Then there's fatuous love. So here, you have passion and commitment, right? You have the desire sexually, you want to stay with them, but you don't have that sort of deeper psychological connection. So you're only really committed to each other for sex. So the examples that are often talked about are these kind of whirlwind courtships. Some people think of like Tom Cruise and Katie Holmes, or, you know, Britney Spears and her many fatuous love affairs. And then finally, is this idea of consummate love. So here, you really have all three components of love, and Sternberg would say this is truly the sort of full deal of love. This is the real thing when you have all three together at the same time. And if you'd like to see more about this, Sternberg's theory of love was also talked about in an open Yale course taught by Professor Paul Bloom, where there's a guest lecture by Peter Salovey here at Yale University on evolution, emotion, and reason, where he talked about love. So if you want to hear more about this, you can also go to the website below and watch a really provocative and engaging lecture on this topic further. So we've talked about love. But what about desire? We've hinted that it's part of, you know, Sternberg's theory of love, but what is desire really? So here what I have side by side is romantic love and the different components we just talked about, and pitting this against sexual desire. So romantic love is really thought to be fostering this commitment role, to stay with someone in order to help rear offspring and foster a long-term commitment. By contrast, sexual desire has what's just called an initiation role, to kind of initiate this kind of appetitive or approach behavior to essentially go and mate with a potential, you know, partner. So really what it's focused on is promoting sexual behavior, getting close to the person, so proximity seeking, and just making physical contact. It's associated with releasing different gonadal, kind of estrogen and androgen hormones, which are thought of as these sexual hormones. And it has a very different kind of behavioral display too, which is pretty funny. So when people are feeling sexual desire, they do things like lip puckers, they lick their lips, they kind of turn their head away, and they make this kind of subtle, coy eye contact. So they'll look at eye contact just briefly for 1 or 2 seconds, that kind of flirtatious quick glance, and they'll do what's called a coy smile. So I'll show you what this looks like. This is also an image courtesy of Dacher Keltner. This is what is thought to be a display of desire. Now think about what we showed earlier, which were the displays of love. Here what you see is this kind of coy, kind of head tilt, the smile, and the eye contact is very brief. It's just this kind of subtle looking back and looking forth very quickly. And this is thought to be a signal that you should pick up that that person is really interested in you and really wants to get close to you sexually. So that's the sort of display of desire. What we see here, it's really interesting, is that some research points to some potential gender differences in the way they signal or cue desire to a partner. So this is a really fun study. Researchers actually spent their time, hundreds of hours, in bars, in single bars. And what they would do is study these brief, kind of 4 to 5 second bursts of behaviors between single women and single men, and actually found that the way that they sort of transmit their feelings of desire look quite different. Okay, so you get in a singles bar, you're a researcher, and you're just watching what's happening around you. And here's what they found. So what do women do when they want to signal desire? They do this funny sort of theatrical kind of a display of different things that include, they arch their back, you know, they kind of sway their hips, they flip their hair. What this is thought to do is almost exemplify this kind of hourglass figure of the female body, and sort of exaggerate these feminine kind of physiological characteristics. By contrast, men do something very different when they're trying to signal desire or interest in a sexual partner. They do things, for example, as you can see here, like amplifying their size and their sort of resource holding potential. So they kind of rock back and forth on their heels, they roll their shoulders, they raise their arms and make these exaggerated gestures. So kind of trying to exemplify their physical size, status, and resources. So it's really fascinating next time you go to a singles bar to just watch the way that men and women behave differently when they're trying to sort of signal their sexual desire and try to gain sexual attention from another partner. So when we think of sexual attraction then, what are the kind of core components? So I think you can think of two different groups or factors that are associated with sexual attraction. The first one is what's thought of as the big three. So proximity, similarity, and familiarity. So these are things that breed sexual attraction. Being close to someone, having some similarity, which is actually sort of counter to this idea that opposites attract. They actually don't attract very much at all. It's more this notion that, you know, birds of a feather flock together. And also familiarity, so sort of being around someone, you know, over time increases sexual attraction. So you often see, you know, sexual relationships between coworkers, office mates, and this has a lot to do with the familiarity. You're just around them, you know, over a frequent or prolonged period of time. Other factors that are thought to sort of promote sexual attraction in the second group, or what I call the remaining four, are the following. So the first one's competence. So not surprisingly, we like people who seem to be competent. But really important, we don't want them to be perfect. And in fact, we are more sexually attracted to people who are competent, but those who occasionally blunder. So maybe they sort of, you know, trip and fall or make like a verbal, you know, faux pas. We actually find that to be something that makes us more attracted to them. So if you want to sort of win someone's attention, definitely, you know, look competent to them, but it's okay to make an occasional stumble or fall, that this actually makes you more desirable in their eyes. Not surprisingly, physical attractiveness has a great impact on the extent to which we find ourselves sexually drawn towards someone. Then there's this idea of gain-loss. So we are attracted to those whose regard for us increases or gains momentum over time. So it's in a sense, you don't want to start right at the beginning with someone, at their maximum level of interest in you, but you seem more attracted to people who sort of over time seem to be more and more interested in you, and whose regard for you kind of increases and increases over time. So you don't want to sort of put all your cards out right away, but you want to sort of let it gradually build up and escalate over time. And this is a really interesting one, misattribution. And this actually, people often use this as advice for sort of how to take someone on a first date. So often, there's this theory of misattribution of arousal. So when you're around someone, and let's say you get physiologically aroused, your heart starts racing, you start sweating. If you're around someone who you might be sexually, as a sexual romantic partner, you're likely to attribute that physiological arousal to them. So, for example, and as a result, if you feel this physiological arousal while you're around the person, you read this as a cue of, oh, well, I must be attracted to them. So people will say that, some of the best first dates are taking your, potential partner on a roller coaster. So something that kind of gets them physically charged, because they're more likely to attribute that physiological arousal not to the roller coaster, but to you. So you want to think about just how you can get people to attribute their arousal to you. And so these are some of the 7 factors that are thought to promote sexual attraction. And again, this is something you can see more of on this Open Yale course at the website below through a guest lecture from Peter Salovey. Okay, so let's now turn to sexual arousal. Here, what we're going to look at is work by Dr. Michael Bailey from Northwestern University, who looked at 2 different ways to measure sexual arousal and looked at differences between men and women who were either heterosexual or homosexual, and really looked at this question of, do patterns in sexual arousal really differ across these groups? So, the first way that he measured sexual arousal was just by using subjective ratings. So this is something that we're all familiar with. And he had, this is actually an image that he loaned to me from his own work, which was a lever here. So where they would have the lever from not at all aroused to extremely aroused at the very top. And this is something that people would be moving sort of manually throughout the task. Okay. He also measured physiological arousal, right? So we know that emotional responses have both subjective and physiological components. So he did this measuring genital arousal both in females using a vaginal plethysmograph, which measures the amplitude of blood flow to the vagina, and with men what he called a penile plethysmograph, measuring the circumference of the penis as a function of blood flow. So this is actually what he used in his lab. So this is for women, this is the plethysmograph, and this is the one used for men in the study. Okay, so he has people hooked up to these 2 computers with these plethysmographs, with these rating dials, and what does he have them do? So here's the study that he did of sexual arousal, and it's quite interesting and has gained a lot of attention and even some controversy. So he brought participants into the lab, okay, and the participants were in 4 categories. There were men and women who were either heterosexual or homosexual. So there were male heterosexual, male homosexual, female heterosexual, and female homosexual. And then what he had them do is watch a series of evocative, sexually arousing film clips with all kinds of different combinations that you could possibly imagine of men and women together, or women and women together, or women and men together, doing a variety of different kinds of sexual acts. So it included things you can see here as following. Right, so you have just all kinds of things to appeal to all different kinds of tastes, right? And so what he wanted to do is to see whether or not men and women really differ in their patterns of sexual arousal when watching these different film clips. And so let's start with the results for men. So what did we see when they saw these different film clips and they were measuring both their subjective ratings and their physiological response of sexual arousal? Interesting. So what you have here is a picture of the self-report dial, and you have 3 colors here. You have the responses to watching a male-male film, a female-female film, or a male and female film. So what they found with subjective responses here is that men who prefer men, so homosexual men, show the greatest self-reported arousal when viewing male-male films. Okay. And over here on the right, men who prefer women, so who self-identify as being heterosexual, show the greatest self-reported arousal to female-female films, followed by male-male films. Okay. So that's what they showed for their subjective response. What about physiological response? So here, what you're seeing, and this is using that plethysmograph that you can see here on the bottom right, is that men who prefer men, so homosexual men, show the greatest physical arousal to the male-male films in purple. That's the left graph. And that men who prefer women, so heterosexual men, show the greatest arousal, again, to these female-female films, followed by male with female films. So this is really consistent with their self-reported response. Okay. So what this work has concluded is that heterosexual men seem to generally show greater or more increased sexual arousal to heterosexual stimuli, which they define as both men with women or women with women, and that homosexual men show the greatest kind of sexual response in terms of their arousal to homosexual stimuli, so men with men. So he concludes that male sexual arousal is really category specific. So you're going to show more arousal to the kind of stimuli that's specific to your self-identified sexual orientation. Okay, now we'll look at women. It's an interesting and very different pattern of results, actually. So here we're going to start with self-reported arousal. Again, same layout that we had before. So on the left, what we see is that heterosexual women, so women who have a male preference, report the greatest arousal for male-female films, followed closely by female-female films. On the right, by contrast, so these are homosexual women, report the greatest arousal by female-female films. Okay. When we get to physiological or sort of genital arousal, what we see is something quite different. So on the left, we see that heterosexual women exhibit equal sexual arousal for any kind of film. Doesn't matter if it's male-male, female-female, or male-female. And when you look at homosexual women, what you see is they exhibit a somewhat greater arousal to female-female films, but also seem to show similarly high arousal across all other film types as well. So this is the interesting kind of controversial part of this research here, is that he concludes that female sexual arousal is not category specific. And he argues in this paper by Chivers et al. That women show more of what he calls a bisexual pattern. So women's sexual arousal is bisexual regardless of their identified sexual orientation, that they show more physiological arousal across a wide variety of stimuli. And so he says this is particularly true of the genital arousal or the physiological responding. So what does this all mean, right? So what this is suggested by this research, by the authors, is that men and women's sexuality may, in fact, be organized differently. And that Michael Bailey's lab showed that men's genital sexual arousal patterns closely track their identified sexual orientations, whereas women's did not. So this is something that will be really interesting to speak with them about when we have our experts in emotion interview, because it's something that's gained a lot of attention and even some controversy as to what it all means. So what I want to move now to are takeaway questions, followed by the expert interview, Michael Bailey, that I've been referring to in his research thus far. So our takeaway questions today on this topic of love, desire, and sex are as follows. First, how is romantic love distinct from sexual desire? What are Sternberg's components of romantic love? We talked about three of them, and we also talked about what it looked like when some but not all of those components were present. So you want to refresh yourself as to what those different forms of love looked like. And then finally, what we just talked about, and what I'd like you to do, is try to describe what these gender-differentiated patterns in sexual arousal were, both for subjective and physiological measures of sexual arousal, and to what extent men and women seem to differ in their patterns of sexual arousal. And with that, I will be turning now to our highly anticipated expert interview as part of the Experts in Emotion series with Dr. Michael Bailey. So Dr. Bailey is a professor of psychology at Northwestern University and highly regarded for his work on the etiology of sexual orientation, gender nonconformity, the genetics of sexual orientation, and the sexual arousal response. He's the author of the well-known book, The Man Who Would Be Queen, The Science of Gender Bending and Transsexualism, which was published in 2003. And his work has received widespread attention in the media, including the Boston Globe, Washington Post, CBS News, just to name a few. So I now turn to our experts in emotion interview with Dr. Michael Bailey.